What makes you tough is your mindset, and I believe anyone can be tough. Our quote today comes from Hicks and Gracie. Welcome to the Darrell McClain Show. I'm your host, Darrell McClain, and let's get into our episode.
Intelligentsia, the interim of sarcasm, the nutty professor, to your whack-ass marmalade. It's T-Bone from T-Bone and Chick Brew in the Morning. Now available in podcast format. Simply search for the T-Bone and Chick Brew podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are sold.
I have to start off the show today with a bit of sad news. Wes Alice, veteran, killed in a motorcycle crash. He will be remembered by his family with a vigil. Family is remembering a local Navy veteran whose life was cut far too short, far too soon. 32-year-old John Holman was killed in a motorcycle crash Monday morning on September the 6th in West Owls. It happened at the intersection of South 84th and West Lincoln Avenue, not far from his home. Police said the 40-year-old driver of the car ignored a traffic light before colliding into Holman, who was going northbound on 84th. Quote, John was an outgoing, caring, compassionate about everything and anything he did. He always saw the best in people, said John's father, Bill Holman. Bill said John had served nearly 10 years in the Navy, even being deployed on anti-piracy operations. He said John was a dedicated family man. First and foremost, he's leaving behind his wife and his two beautiful children, both young daughters, as well as his parents and siblings. Bill said John was always the life of the party. Quote, he does make everybody laugh. That's what he was. He was always joking, said Bill. And you know, there were times where he was serious too. And it's like he was compassionate. Like I said before, he was compassionate about what he believed in. Bill said John got the motorcycle he was riding just last weekend and spent the day with him working on it. The last time Bill got to spend quality time with his son. It wasn't enough, said Bill. Wednesday night, around 5:30 p.m., people will be gathering to remember John riding from his home over the accident site and then to Humboldt Park. They'll be going down to Humboldt Park by the beer garden where him and his wife were married for a candlelight vigil. West Owls police say they're investigating the crash and said the driver, who didn't seem to be impaired at the time, is cooperating with police. So, I do have to say, John Holman was my good friend. You know, we worked together at my first command in the United States Navy at the Marine Corps Security Force Battalion in Kings Bay, Georgia. I have very few close friends, and John was definitely one of them. I had the pleasure of meeting John at my very first command. He came to my hometown with me to Jacksonville, Florida, as we both love wrestling, and he helped me coach at the local high school that was then called Robert E. Lee. When he got out of the military, John actually became a journalist in Milwaukee and used to do a show called One Milwaukee. When I actually wanted to start this podcast, I called John and he talked to me several days for hours, even told me everything I needed to do to get started with the show. I would often call him to pick his brain about public policy, and he was very knowledgeable, factual, didn't just spout his opinion, had no problem doing the heavy lifting and doing some research. He was, just like his father said, a wonderful family man who was taken away very, very suddenly. John was only 32 years old, and he did get that motorcycle just last weekend. So it's really sad to see. But so I do have to start off the show with a rest in peace to my good friend, John Holman. So if you guys are aware, the show is fully listener supported by some very loyal patrons who think that my voice is important enough, and they have a bit of shekels to spare to allow me to do this for the general public. One of them kindly sends me questions, and so I'm going to start off, before I get into the deeper part of the show, to answer some of the questions that he had for me on basically a bit of a follow-up about the last show that I did about, I think that show was labeled Unconstitutional Vaccine Mandate. So the question reads as such, Daryl, have you received the COVID vaccine? If so, both shots. I think you told the audience before that you have. I thought in an early episode you had mentioned that you did. So, and he went on to say that he thinks it's something that the audience will be very interested in. So, thank you for the question, one. I 100% somewhat disagree that the audience would be concerned about my particular health status. I kind of have the assumption that most of my audience are either libertarians or conservatives who don't really care if people are vaccinated or unvaccinated. They just have a problem with the government or any type of mandate being forced on them, especially when I have to deal with the nuances of the fact that a lot of their businesses were closed down because of the government shutdown. And I'm going to go back to saying something that I used to say on previous shows that I think it was rather erudite of me, so I'll say it again. The government conscripted people by force to close their businesses, which is why I believe the government had the responsibility to pay people for said closed businesses. I think it was Samson Saucer, one of the athletes I sponsor, who said something to me, something that in the essence was the audacity for a person to tell another human being you are not essential enough to be able to go out and feed your family. And so that is kind of the viewpoint that I look at these things from. Now, when it comes to my personal medical history, I will say that I do get these particular vaccinations. I actually got the Moderna vaccine. I normally, in my personal life, I am very, I guess you could call me vaccine hesitant. I'm normally a person who doesn't regularly get the flu vaccine. I have to be damn near dying to get to the hospital for anything. I really, really believe that, you know, in home remedies and prayer and supplication and buffeting my body into submission. But I got these vaccines totally based on just two fundamental things that I had to wrestle with in my actual life outside of the show. I still do private security contracts. I deal with the general public on a daily basis. So that was very important because of the amount of people that I come in contact with. I also do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And so it was more of me wanting to try to protect people at the gym. And also, my best friend just had a very, well, had her first child. And one of the prerequisites for coming to visit said young child was to be vaccinated. So it was one of those things where the entire time I heard the government talking about the vaccine, I was not interested because I do not, as a matter of principle, believe almost anything the government's saying. So, and there are anecdotal reasons for me personally and historical reasons for I think we should wrestle with as a collective. But when your friend has a child and it's the a first they ever had, and you know, and they have that prerequisite, like I said, I did it for that reason. Now, I was also somewhat accused by another patron of a bit of biased. They said while I was very clear in the choice of observation, their gut felt like I was biased towards the vaccine because they didn't recall any positive points I made for getting the vaccine. So I will say that that is a true assessment, and that is basically because the show that I was doing at the time wasn't about the positives and negatives of the actual vaccine, so it really, to me, wasn't the topic. The topic that I was focused on in that show was, did I think the mandates or the government could mandate a person, a private person, that is, put any type of drug into their body? And I leaned on the side that it was unconstitutional, and I did my best to lay out the constitutional argument. When it comes to the efficacy of some of these vaccines, like I said, I took the Moderna one. I think that I think the evidence is practically out. If you take the vaccine and you get COVID, it is more than likely going to not, it'll protect you from one of the more severe cases. And I think that that is shown out as a broad thing from what I have seen. I have seen the other side where people have taken the vaccine and passed away. But I've also, you know, we could talk about statistical evidence versus anecdotal evidence. And when I looked into the numbers of the people who had actually taken the vaccine and had very bad reactions, even until death, it was below 1%. It was like 0.1% of the population. So it was one of the things where I say that is about as good as it's going to get when it comes to any type of medication or foreign substance you're putting inside of your body. So my biggest concern in that episode was mostly just about the separation of powers, full stop. I have always taken the libertarian approach to these sorts of issues. I do not believe that the government owns its citizens. This is why I've always wrestled with people about the death penalty. I don't believe the government or the state should have the right to kill people just because they were born there. And I think it's a very slippery slope, a bad precedent that is set, the fact that we allow that to happen. And in that same vein, I don't think the government has the power to tell you what you could put in your body because you were born here. Politicians, to me, and a lot of this is, have to remember, we are a republic. So we don't actually have direct democracy where we make decisions on issues. We vote for people who then make decisions on issues on our behalf. That being said, even the people that we vote in to make said issues on our behalf, I do not trust them enough to make these decisions full stop, to where I give them that type of permission over my own body. I just am not interested in it. I think that if you think about the politician you don't like, not the one you do like, you'll think about this a lot more. But anyway, I will say that it was a very good question. Both of those questions. Well, one question and one observation. And thank you. And please keep them coming in. To stay on that topic of vaccines and vaccine hesitancy and vaccine misinformation, I don't know if you guys heard about the Nicki Minaj story that took Twitter by storm, was all over MSNBC, and even made its rounds on Fox News. It was actually so funny when I heard it. It is going to be called the case of the swollen testicles. Let's go to Crystal, Kyle, and friends to help me discuss some of this.
Minaj went on Twitter the other day. Everybody knows this story now because it's the biggest thing online. But Nicki Minaj went on Twitter the other day and said something along the lines of, I don't have the tweet queued up in front of me, but I'll give you the gist of it. The gist of it was, hey, make your own decision and don't be bullied into getting the vaccine, because I just heard from my cousin in Trinidad that his friend got the vaccine, got a big old swollen ball sack, and is impotent, and he was supposed to get married, and now that woman left him because of his big old swollen impotent balls.
So one thing that's funny about that, I'm sorry to break the news, Nicki Minaj's cousins, whatever, look, the guy was cheating, and that's an STD.
And so everybody, like, we were all sitting there. I remember when I was talking, I was like, I had to do a double take. I was like, Nicki, what?
This is one where we check to make sure, like, is this real?
Yeah, like, this is a parody account or some shit. I was like, what? What are you talking about? And then, of course, instantly politicized like that. So Tucker Carlson goes out on his show and he's like, here's somebody who's not a slave on the Democratic plantation. And she's thinking for herself. And she wants you to know, careful of the vaccine, might get some big old swollen balls. She's just asking questions. That's all she's doing. She's just
she's reasonable, I think he said.
She's just telling, you know, she's just telling her personal story. Who are you to judge about that? So he does that. Which actually I think was, maybe we'll have a disagreement on this. I actually think that was savvy politically.
Yes, very savvy.
Yes, because that's in the same way that, like, you know, sort of TPUSA aligned with Kanye to be like, we're hip, we're with it. Tuck, 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 tuck. That's exactly the sort of thing that Tucker was doing. Like, look, a black female rapper who's really cool, who I happen to be defending right now. Should I get an even younger audience to believe all my bullshit? That's sort of the sense I got from Tucker.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. And he ultimately baited people into the second part of the dynamic, which is then, do you want to set this up, a Hassan part?
Well, yeah, so what happens is Nicki tweets a short clip from Tucker Carlson's show when he was given, like, a monologue, and it's semi-defending her, and she tweets that video clip with a little bullseye emoji to be like, this guy gets it.
Right.
And so Hassan Piker jumps in the replies and basically says, like, do you know that this guy's a white nationalist? And so then Nicki fires back and says, this is actually, I'm going to give you verbatim what it says.
Got it.
Right. I can't speak to, agree with, or even look at someone from a particular political party. By the way, white nationalist is not a political party. People aren't human anymore. If you're black and a Democrat tells you to shove marbles up your ass, you simply have to. If another party tells you to look out for the bus, stand there and get hit. So, you know, that's her being like, don't make this partisan, you know, what is that even relevant to the conversation that we're having? Believe it or not, I might surprise people here. I half agree with Nicki in this sense that, like, yeah, the fact, even if Tucker is a white nationalist, that is not relevant to the conversation about vaccination.
Right.
Like, Hitler could say, I like dogs. That doesn't mean, like, if somebody says, I like dogs, you could say, like, did you know Hitler liked dogs? Like, that's just not relevant to the conversation.
Right.
So I'm going to somewhat jump in here and agree with Kyle that I half agree with Nicki, but I'm also going to agree that Hassan Piker, formerly of the Young Turks, Cenk Uygur's nephew, also did a good point in pointing that out, because it may be something that Nicki didn't know, right? So the nuanced thing is this. I bought Tucker Carlson's last book, right? It was actually a really good book, and I agree with most of what he said in the book. And it is one of those things where you really have to understand that you have to find people are that have ideals that you can agree with and on the other side of the aisle. And that is actually how you start to have, I guess, coalitions. So in a lot of other countries, we have to have coalition governments. So that's kind of the way I think about these things. When I have to pick with my right wingers, I have to pick between Mark Levin, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, right? And so I'm going to pick Tucker Carlson almost 9 times out of 10 when it comes to that type of bunch. Tucker Carlson is much more reasonable than Sean Hannity. Tucker Carlson is much more reasonable than the great one, Mark Levin. So that is kind of, you know, what it is. Tucker Carlson is not going to be Russell Brand. He's not going to be Noam Chomsky. He's not going to be Howard Zinn. He's not going to be Cornel West. But Tucker Carlson will have Cornel West on. Tucker Carlson will have Glenn Greenwald on. So it's one of those things to where it's like we really have to pick, you know, I guess pick your poison. So that's point number one. Point number two is the essence of what is being said, where it's like just because I agree with one person about one thing does not mean I agree with the totality of every argument they have ever made about every subject. So it could be 100% legitimate that Tucker Carlson is whatever Hassan Piker called him, but he could be right about 70% of the other things that he believes in, and I'm just interested on where we agree. I'll pick apart what we disagree on when that point comes up. When it comes to Nicki Minaj, I do think that it is a difference where it's like, yes, she did engage in a bunch of, so let's say, conspiracy theory and or misinformation, but I also think she had a very good point where she said you can't be bullied into these types of things. It goes back to the larger conversation I was having in the beginning when the Patreon sent me the question about the vaccine. And I said a lot of people, they don't really care if you have a vaccine or not. They're not interested in being bullied into that decision by the government. And I have to add, being bullied into that decision by a government that a lot of them, in fact, did not vote for.
Right. And it's like this instinct on the left always to say, like, if you associate yourself with one thing that a person says, that automatically
means so now you're buying it wholesale,
sanctioning wholesale whatever their ideology is and whatever they're selling on a daily basis.
Correct. So, but now, before I don't get it twisted, now comes my massive disagreement with Nikki, which is the more important part, which is this. And this is my advice for everybody. I don't care who you are. For the love of God, stop taking anecdotes and forming your entire worldview solely based off anecdotes. So by the way, the health minister from Trinidad, they didn't comment on this for like a day and a half or 2 days. And then they call a press conference, homeboy goes out there and he's like, just so everybody understands, the story's not true. We went around, we were asking people, anybody have some swollen ass balls here? And nobody had some swollen ass balls. So Nikki, like, you sort of got
official press conference of like, Nikki is wasting our time, but we went and we checked and there are no reports of swollen balls. And soccer told me this. I'll have to double check it, but they don't use the same vaccine. They're not doing Moderna or Pfizer or Johnson & Johnson. Yeah. I think they're using the Chinese one, Sino, whatever. So even if there are no swollen balls, even if there were swollen balls as a vaccine side effect, it's a different vaccine.
Yeah.
So every level, but your point is, I think, actually a really important one. And
it's the only point. You know what I mean?
Right. And the fact that it gets turned into this whole, like, silly theatrical situation. Joy Reid was all in on, like, Nikki's terrible. And Tucker's immediately, like,
dragging Joy Reid, like, nobody's
that one,
business.
You can't even read the tweet because there's all kinds of slurs, et cetera.
She
in
called
there.
Her
old
Uncle
homophobic,
Tommyana.
Her,
I was like,
and that
damn, son.
Wasn't even the worst thing she called her in that tweet.
I probably didn't even see
all
the tweets
then.
By the
way, but the old homophobic blog posts and the hackers came up.
Well,
and
that,
also,
I sort of respect that she brought that up. Cause just
So, yeah, I posted some of those tweets on my Instagram. And you can follow me on Instagram at the Daryl McClain Show. But when she did kind of engage in a bit of the, I'll say, name-calling. What would you expect? She had been called out, and she is, after all, she's not a politician, she's a rapper. So she bucked back very hard. She brought up the tweets from Julianne Reed circa Donald Trump era, which Julianne Reed said she did not trust the CDC, and she had a lot of people would have trouble trusting the CDC ever again. This is what Julianne Reed said when Donald Trump was president. Nicki Minaj also brought up the fact that Julianne Reed had several homophobic blog posts, and then when it was time to fess up and be taken to the woodshed, Julianne Reed lied and said that, oh, I didn't write those blog posts. Someone hacked me and wrote them to basically besmirch my character. Anyway, so that is just giving you a bit of context of what those tweets actually said.
Just fuck Joy Reid. Anyway, go on.
Also,
it's not relevant to the conversation, but she needs to get her comeuppance for that. Is that the word I'm looking for? Comeuppance?
Yes, that is the word. Also, she brought up an old tweet from Joyce during the Trump administration where she was like, who could ever trust the FDA again, even if Biden gets elected? Because this has all been such
right.
a mess.
Look, I'm sorry. I don't know how well you know her, so don't say anything here. I'll be the one to talk. But yeah, Joy Reid's a fucking hack. Obviously. But on the flip side, Nikki, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, you need to understand that you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm not saying that as a personal attack. I'm just saying, like, when you've amassed a quadrillion followers, don't go out there and say some medical shit based on Dickie McGee's acts.
Literally.
Like, you don't know what you're talking about. So, by the way, to my original point, which is everybody falls for this. It's not just Nicki Minaj. I don't want to just pick on Nicki Minaj. Everybody does this thing where it's like, I have a friend who has a friend whose nuts fell out of his eye socket because he took fucking penicillin. And it's like, first of all, no. Second of all, even if you did, I don't care about your anecdote. It doesn't mean anything to me. I care about the data, because the data is what? A collection of all of the anecdotes. That's what the data is. Tell me what all the anecdotes say. So, just on the vaccine thing, we just got these numbers from Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah, this is interesting.
So get this. In Pennsylvania, unvaccinated or not fully vaccinated people have so far accounted for 97% of the deaths, 95% of the hospitalizations, and 94% of the cases. I don't care about your swollen ball sack, bro. I care about this. I care about what the data says. And so, yes, she is sort of feeding into vaccine hesitancy, which is wildly irresponsible. But what you see here is, this is what happens with human nature, too. It's like, and maybe there's a lesson here about shaming and how it doesn't really work. Because the second Nikki
what
felt
I just
like there
said,
was pushback
what
that
I
she
said.
Viewed as unfair,
yeah.
She was like, I will run into the arms of Fox News and Tucker Carlson gladly.
Exactly.
That is actually a really important political lesson. And that's...
I 100% agree. You cannot shame someone into the right positions. The second somebody feels like they are being attacked, 9 times out of 10, they dig their heels in and they go right in the direction you don't want them to go in. You cannot shame somebody into correct policy positions. You can't even shame people most of the time into theological or religious positions. You can't shame people into moral positions. Most of the time, when you try to shame someone, they will push back at you with vigor.
I mean, that's a silly response.
Totally
right?
Silly.
Just like
she has agency. She's an adult.
Right. And just like it was silly when it was like Elizabeth Warren supporters were like, people were mean to me online, so now I'm going to support Biden instead of Bernie.
Yeah.
And you're like, people were mean to you and now you don't support universal healthcare? Like, what?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. But it definitely
happens. Without a doubt.
It definitely happens. And you see it happening in real time where the more like full of contempt and condescension and shaming and judgment comes from the left, the more people are like, oh, well, what are these people who are being nice to me? What do they have to say?
Yeah. It's really sad. It's sad. I get sad when I watch that unfold.
Well, because
you saw it in real, like you saw her going down the slide in real time.
Yes.
Like now, she, next thing you know, she's going to be at a TPUSA event with Candace Owens.
Tucker could have her on his pro.
And it's actually pretty funny because if you go look at the origin of Candace Owens, she was bullied and targeted heavily online when Candace used to be somewhat very liberal, if not on the left completely. And she was bullied by a liberal, I want to say the girl is like a gay rights activist, about Candace was trying to come up with some website, and the person pushed back and started doing all these things, and there was an investigation, and during the investigation, Candace realized that it was actually a Democrat that was doing a lot of the bullying, cyberbullying that was to her. And so Candace really, in my assessment, ran hard to the right. That's when she came out as a Trump supporter, and the rest is history.
It's program. Totally. Who knows?
Totally.
Who knows? But I also think the anecdote thing is important, and I think it's something the right really understands, because they do this all the time, and it's so effective of, like, they'll pick out one instance. It used to be in the Tea Party era of, like, government waste.
Right.
They'll find,
yeah,
like,
they funded lobster sex research.
My right, exactly. Yeah. Or my favorite example is they found some conference where they technically on the bill paid, like, $20 a muffin or something like that. Uh-huh. And it was, like, endless Fox News segments about the outrage of these $20 muffins. They'll find one thing. They'll make it very real for people, very tangible, and then use that to say, and this is what's going on across the board. And I think human beings, one of our, you know, we are not fundamentally, like, totally rational people. We don't deal with numbers particularly well. We don't deal with data particularly well. So those anecdotes are very powerful. Those stories are a lot of times more politically powerful than a billion samples of people getting the vaccine and doing really well with it. So Democrats tend to run around with, like, here's my spreadsheet, and here's my chart, and here's my numbers, and here's my graph. And Fox News will come in with, like, yeah, but did you hear about Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend's swollen balls? And it lands because we're wired to think in terms of stories and anecdotes. So while it would be better if people would look at the data, I also think it's important to recognize that that is a common human failing and flaw in the system.
You couldn't be more correct. And because that's the reality, I'm going to go ahead. Let's talk about something that happened with us not too long ago. Sagar had COVID, told the world he had COVID.
Yeah.
He was mildly symptomatic for one show where you
were sitting, we were doing the show
right next to him for the entire show. For hours, you're sitting next to him. He's mildly symptomatic. You should have gotten COVID.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get COVID.
Especially Delta variant, way more infectious, very likely.
And I'm with you all the time. I was just with you immediately after that, too. You should have gotten COVID. I should have gotten COVID.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't get COVID. I didn't get COVID.
Right.
You're vaccinated. I'm vaccinated.
Right.
I'm convinced that's why.
That's
so if you want to play the anecdote game, fucking anecdote game. You want another anecdote? Every single person in my personal life who's gotten vaccinated, nobody has had anything worse than very mild symptoms for like half a day.
Same.
How about that? I had a headache for like 2 hours, 24 hours after I got the shot, then I was perfectly fine. You, what, the night of, you felt a little off, a little like fevery.
Yeah, no,
and then the next morning,
no big deal.
Done. My mother, virtually nothing. My sister, absolutely nothing for my sister.
Big deal.
So you want to play the anecdote game? I can play the anecdote game all day long. See, the problem is, people on our side of this discussion, we're more honest. So I like to go right to the data because that's all that fucking matters.
Right.
But if we are really wired in human nature to only play the anecdote game, fine, I'll play the anecdote game and I'll destroy you at the anecdote game because I'm correct on it.
But there's another issue here, which is that I think the scarier, more salacious things also land.
Right. Nobody's going to write an article about the thing I
about,
just said.
Like,
there's been 90,000 on the swollen balls.
Fine,
nobody's
going
to say Kyle Kalinske and Cristobal should have gotten COVID and didn't because they're vaccinated. Nobody's going to write an article saying that.
Right. Right. So anyway, it's silly. The whole thing is extremely silly, but I actually think it is very revealing about the way that these things unfold, the way that oftentimes people sort of end up getting pushed to right-wing ideologies because they feel so judged and like held in contempt by some folks on the left, especially the liberal left, and the way that these little cultural moments immediately devolve into just total sectarianism.
Absolutely. And just to be clear, and I know you would agree with this as well, it works the other way as well. It's not just like, you know, the outrage mobs only go in one direction. They go in every which direction.
Of course.
And unfortunately, I think it is a failure of human nature, again, to get back to it, that like, Yeah, people's reaction, their emotional reaction, tends to be immediate aversion to anybody who's given them some sort of criticism. And it, on the one hand, that's understandable because we're, you know, we only want so much conflict in our lives. When it goes overboard, we feel unfairly under attack and we're like, can't handle it. But yeah, you would just hope that with a little bit of time and removing yourself from the situation and thinking about it, one could be more rational.
So I actually think the right is better in this regard, because you see this like with Rogan, something we've talked about,
yeah.
How they'll ignore the million things that he says that they would vehemently disagree with.
Universal healthcare,
yeah,
all that
but
stuff.
Then
and the
second
wars.
That he says something that they find convenient, then
yeah.
They're embracing him.
Like,
he's
oh,
our
he's
guy.
Critical of trans something. And
right,
like,
he's
oh,
us.
He's
right,
yeah.
Or he said some weird thing about the vaccine. Like, we love this guy, you know, and they'll ignore and embrace as their own. Whereas the left is the polar opposite. They only fixate on the things where they
True.
Wildly disagree with him.
I agree that they're better in that respect, sort of like
savvier.
Claiming
I'm not saying
something.
It's like morally better. They're just savvier.
No, I know. But,
yeah.
But the, it...
I agree. I think the Joe Rogan case is a very interesting example. As a media critique, I really feel like that a lot of the media, the mainstream media, have such disdain and contempt for Joe Rogan because... He gets out of their bubble, and I mean in the sense of they are legacy media. If you want to go somewhere for credibility, they have put themselves up as a stable of credibility journalism. They have put themselves up as resistance journalism or resistant liberals and the opposition to the people in power, et cetera, et cetera. And you have somebody like Joe Rogan who did not go to school to be a journalist, did not go to school for communications, et cetera. Somebody who picked his potatoes and meat from MMA and from Fear Factor and from his time in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and, you know, under John Jock Machado and being friends with Eddie Bravo and stuff like that. And he is an anomaly to them. He's something that they don't understand. And because he comes in as an outsider in the same way Donald Trump and these other people did, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Ron Paul, they do not like that. And they laser focus on to try to destroy things that they do not understand because it did not come in the building the same way that they did. And, you know, so they will hyper-focus on a legacy media on anything that Joe Rogan says that they disagree with, that they find is inaccurate. But the thing is, if you could just take a step back and look, it is not the same way they engaged with each other. I mean, Brian Williams is seen as one of the most professional people in the legacy media. But remember, a few years back, he had to come out with the fact that he out and right was fabricating entire stories, putting himself into places that he wasn't there, making up events that did not happen, etc., etc. Brian Williams is still right now on MSNBC. And that is just one example. Sean Hannity, during the Donald Trump administration and the George Bush administration, made himself a wholesale subsidiary for the president that was in power. Everybody knew Sean Hannity was in the tank for both of those Republican presidents. He still gets to walk around in legacy media and pretend like he is a credible source of journalistic integrity. And so when Joe Rogan comes on and says something like, well, you know, I'm just asking questions, or I'm an idiot, I don't know anything about these things, and he'll let somebody on that you disagree with, and he lets them talk for 4 hours at length, the media has a problem with that. They have a big problem with that, especially because, well, they don't allow their guests to come on and talk for an entire show. They get about 2 minutes or so, and they have to try to somewhat put very complex topics into sound bites, and that leads to this entire industry where nobody's actually talking about anything. They're speaking in a way to where they're trying to make headlines, they're trying to say something clever, something snazzy, something witty, instead of actually getting to the meat and potatoes of an actual substantive argument or conversation.
They do also do the outrage mob thing that would then push people further into their own
yeah,
left-wing camp. So we've
sure.
seen it a million times, whether it's somebody who gets, like, remember when Martin Bashir did the thing about you know, Sarah Palin shitting in Sarah Palin's mouth or something.
I remember that very well.
Then he got fired, and then, you know, it was like they went after him so aggressively. Now, these are the same people who care to say, oh, we care about free speech, you know, even if it's politically incorrect, you should be able to say whatever you want to say. Okay, well, then until somebody disagrees with you and says something that you find vulgar, then all of a sudden fire him. And so, of course, he's going to become more hardened in his beliefs. And there's a million examples of that that cut both directions. So that's my point. But yeah, I agree that they're savvier in that respect of, like, claiming something as their own.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm
and they're
sure,
doing that with Nikki right
I'm
now.
I'm sure Nikki has said lots of things that they would very much disagree with. And on a normal night on Tucker, you'll find him, like, very morally outraged about the degenerate language in rap music or whatever. Yeah. But for this instance, he's going to put all that aside.
Yeah.
Nikki's amazing. She's great because she happens to have said something he finds politically convenient in this moment.
Yeah, tell us your thoughts on Anaconda, Tucker.
Yeah.
You know?
He probably has. I wonder if he's done a segment on that. He's very possible.
Probably touched himself to that. Anyway.
I blame my Patreon for taking me down this path about vaccinations. So that's why you all had to hear the case of the swollen testicles. Our next topic is actually going to be about poverty, which I'm actually some good news. Poverty fell overall in 2020 as a result of massive stimulus checks and unemployment aid, the Census Bureau said. And now the official rate rose slightly to 11.4%, but the agency says that after accounting for pandemic relief aid, the poverty rate fell to 9.1%. The uninsured population also rose slightly as well. So the U.S. poverty rate fell overall in 2020. A SERB, a surprising decline, largely due to the swift and substantial federal relief that Congress enacted at the start of the pandemic to try to prevent widespread financial hardship as the nation experienced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. The U.S. Census Bureau reported that poverty fell to 9.1% in 2020 after accounting for all of the government aids, the lowest rate on record, and a significant decline from 11.8% in 2019. Nearly 8.5 million people were lifted out of poverty last year. I'll say that again. Nearly 8.5 million people were lifted out of poverty last year. An unprecedented change in a single year that was largely attributed to the stimulus payments. Poverty in the United States is defined as a family of four living on less than about $26,250 a year. This is a really phenomenal result, said Elian Waxman, a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. But a lot of that aid made a difference, including for families with children, won't be extended, end quote. Now, as the economy recovers from the depths of the coronavirus pandemic, White House officials are hoping that more Americans will be able to find good-paying jobs that keep them out of poverty. But deep inequalities remain, and there are troubling signs that the recovery aid could stall. Black and Hispanic women, for example, continue to lag behind in the recovery, along with Americans without a college degree. Meanwhile, strong job gains earlier in the summer have faded as surging coronavirus cases, mostly among the unvaccinated people, weigh on spending and hiring. President Biden is urging Congress to enact more programs to help the poor and working class as part of a $3.5 trillion package that would make significant investment in many parts of the economy. Top White House aides point to the success of the pandemic aid as an example of how additional resources can make a dramatic difference in decreasing poverty and hardship. Both conservatives argue that the safety net programs exacerbated worker shortages and add to already skyrocketing levels of federal debt. And of course, conservatives say that is unnecessary. The extensive federal relief money enacted during the coronavirus pandemic is widely credited by economists and policy experts for preventing another Great Depression. when looking at individual programs, the stimulus payments alone without taking into consideration expenses and other factors would have lifted 11.7 million people out of poverty, census officials estimate. And they said enhanced unemployment aid prevented 5.5 million people from falling into poverty. A separate report last week showed that because of the aid, hunger did not rise as well in 2020. Quote, this really highlights the importance of our social safety net, said Lena Fox, the chief of the Census Bureau of Poverty Statistics Branch. The annual census findings also underscored the deep impact of so many job losses last year. Median income declined sharply to 2.9% to $67,521, and the number of people lacking health insurance throughout 2020 grew to 28 million, nearly 2 million more than it was in 2019. It was the fourth year in a row that the ranks of the uninsured actually swelled. Still, after accounting for the government aid, poverty declined in every age group, racial and ethnic group, and education level. Some of the largest declines in poverty were reported for families headed by single mothers, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and adults without a high school degree. Now, quote, the federal government responded quickly and significantly, and it's very clear that those efforts prevented a sharp rise in poverty, said James Sullivan, an economic professor at the University of Notre Dame. The concern is that we would see poverty rise again, but we've now seen the relief packages expire. Allison Mertz of Kansas City, Missouri, was one of those whose standard of living drastically changed after the pandemic struck and employers slashed jobs as much as the economy shut down. Before the pandemic, Mertz worked part-time so she could finish her bachelor's degree. Her fiancé planned to support them financially, but his 80-hour-a-week job in the oil industry was reduced to 20 hours. They then struggled to pay rent and to buy groceries and lacked money for major things like car repairs. They went on to say, that couple, Mertz and her fiance grew up in poverty and had tried hard to climb out of it. Mertz said they credited the stimulus payment and food assistance with preventing them from falling below the poverty line. Quote, getting those stimulus checks was a game-changing moment, Mertz said. It's just made a big difference. It seems like a small amount of money, but it was so much money when you have next to nothing. Now, Mertz is 30. And now has a full-time job in the insurance industry after finishing her bachelor's degree, and her fiance's hours have actually rebounded. They actually just signed a lease in a nicer apartment. So poverty would have jumped to 12.7% without the stimulus payments last year, the Census Bureau said, noting that the majority of job losses were among workers earning less than $34,000 who had little to no in savings. It's actually very sad. Please remember that statistic that I used to hammer in our heads when I started the show last year, that it was about 50% of the American population who did not have $400 in their account for an emergency. That number ticked up when it got to about $700. It was about 60%. When it got to $1,000, it was like 70 to 75% of people who did not have $1,000 in their savings. So by the second measure, which leaves out much of the federal stimulus payments, poverty rose to 11.4% from 10.5%. But experts said that that figure does not capture the real-world effect of the government aid. So I'm going to link to this data from the Census Bureau in the show notes. And in those show notes as well, it'll have the study that came out last week as well about the poverty rate falling. The other study that came out that was not from the Census Bureau. And you can read that data. Got a nice breakdown and some charts if you're a chart person in its entirety. Now, when it comes to that 3.4 billion dollars or so, we all know all eyes have been on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema actually get all the attention. But Kristen Sinema could even be a bigger obstacle for Democrats and their spending plans. Senate Democrats were riding on the high on the afternoon of July 28. A long-delayed bipartisan infrastructure package had finally come together, with many senators eager to finish the bill and move forward with a multi-trillion dollar piece of economic, climate, and social legislation, President Biden's signature Build Back Better plan. But one senator, Senator Kristen Sinema, the Democrat from Arizona, punctured the gleeful atmosphere with a warning shot. While Democrat members of the Senate Budget Committee may have agreed on the size of the second bill, she did not. Quote, while I support the beginning of this process, I do not support a bill that could cost $3.5 trillion. Now, Sinema said that in a statement that struck some of her fellow Democrats as poorly timed, coming just hours before she was counting on a united caucus to advance the infrastructure deal she had painstakingly negotiated. Sinema, 45, is not the only Senate Democrat to raise pointed concerns about the size of the party's legislative agenda. In fact, her objections have been seen largely obscured by much more prominent complaints from fellow Senator Senator Joe Manchin III, the Democrat from West Virginia, who has aired about the left's wing ambitions in newspapers, op-eds, TV's news appearance, and nearly daily comments to reporters. Sinema, on the other hand, has remained almost entirely silent. While Manchin appeared on multiple Sunday news programs this month, Sinema hasn't done a national television interviews actually all this week, but her vote in evenly divided Senate is just as crucial as Manchin's, and some Democrats quietly fear her objections could be even more nettlesome. She remained silent when asked about her priorities in shaping the bill at Capitol this week, and a spokesman, John Lombard, said in a statement Wednesday that Sinema is continuing to work in good faith with her colleagues and President Biden as the legislation develops. Now, according to more than a dozen interviews with her Senate colleagues and aides involved in the negotiations, Sinema and her staff have been closely involved in the talks, asking detailed questions to several key lawmakers and committee aides to understand the justifications for proposed spending and tax increases. Quote, she's going through the whole package and has very specific concerns and questions about very specific pieces, said Senator Christopher A. Coons, the Democrat from Delaware, who said Tuesday that he personally field questions from Sinema about his own proposals from the new Civilian Climate Corps, a multi-billion dollar line item that is a key priority for the left. Sinema Coons said wanted to know more about whether the program could be quickly grown to scale that its supporters envision. Quote, it is a perfectly reasonable question, Coons added. I spoke up in a caucus and said, you know, this is one of those ones I'm working really hard on. And she said, okay, I need answers to this, this, and this. Other Democrats familiar with Sinema behind the scenes who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive negotiations said a major priority has been to ensure that the matters that were negotiated out for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, additional transit funding, for instance, do not reappear in the Build Back Better bill, which would violate agreement with Republicans to keep the two bills separate. Sinema, the Democrats said, also have been exploring ways to means test some programs to target their effect on the nation's neediest at the moment when liberals argue that much of the larger swath of Americans need help from the federal government. Her voting record of Sinema also provides warning, notably with Democrats eyeing $2 trillion more in tax increases to offset their spending plans. Sinema has publicly aligned with Republicans on several tax bills. As a House member, she was one of seven Democrats to support a bill from the Grand Old Party, a bill eliminating the federal estate tax in 2015, and was one of only three Democrats who in 2018 voted permanently to extend individual tax cuts passed by Republicans the year prior. Quote, she does not like tax increases, said one Republican senator who worked with Sinema and spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe her views. In a signal of how seriously cinema's views are being taken, she met with President Biden at the White House on Wednesday morning, with Manchin attending a similar meeting later that day. Lombard characterized the meeting as productive, and a White House spokesman did not respond to requests for a comment. Go big or go home, baby. Go big or go home. That is my policy prescription when it comes to this type of thing. I am somebody who believe the Democrats are going to take a massive amount of losses in the midterms. A massive amount of losses because they have not done what they said they came to Washington to do. And in a country that is hyper-partisan, they are going to, in fact, pay for that. So, you might as well go big. You might as well deliver on some of these promises. You know, things like the voters' rights bills, whether it's the John Lewis Act or whatever Stacey Abrams is going for and on a national scale. Because I'd be surprised if Democrats keep the Senate. I do think they may keep the House. I think they're going to lose the Senate. And I think you're going to have some real divided government, which if they get the Senate and get Mitch McConnell back in charge, the Grim Reaper is definitely going to stop all legislation in its tracks. I was actually looking at some analysis from former Republican congressman from Florida, my former congressman, Joe Scarborough, right? And it actually surprised me, his take. So I'm going to let you listen to this take from, again, when you hear, remember, former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough on these tax bills and $3.5 trillion, whatever. As well, I'm going to go to a bit of a conversation, let's say, in the media between the Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Bernie Sanders on Vermont about this very issue.
The top marginal tax rate is proposed to be raised to 39.6 from 37%, but that, as you know, doesn't get at the way the super wealthy and corporations make their money and avoid taxes.
Well, and we see it every year. I don't understand what's going on when you have the people writing the tax bill for the Democrats saying they're concerned about moderates' concerns. What, do they want Jeff Bezos and Amazon to keep paying $0 in tax? Is that a moderate concern, or is that actually a lobbyist's concern? Because over the past few years, there are corporations that have paid zero taxes in a year, and just over the past couple of years, that includes Amazon, Chevron, Avis, Delta, Eli Lilly, GM, Goodyear, Halliburton, Honeywell, IBM, Netflix, Occidental Petroleum, Owens Corning, Salesforce, U.S. Steel, last year, Archer Daniels, FedEx, Nike, on and on and on. Are moderates really concerned that those corporations may actually have to pay millions of dollars in tax? Because right now they're paying zero. And billionaires are continuing to figure out how to pay little or nothing. Hedge fund titans are paying taxes at lower rates than their clerical employees. And the people who chauffeur their Bentleys, you think that's demagoguery? You think that's popping? No, it's not. No, that's the fact. Billionaires' capital, it doesn't get taxed. Workers' wages do. And so now Democrats in Congress are saying we need to raise the taxes on people who are working, but leave billionaires alone as they continue to amass capital and continue. Listen to me here. Because everybody hates income redistribution. That makes you a socialist, doesn't it? If you're for a scheme that redistributes wealth. Well, let me tell you something. In the world we've lived in over the past 40 years, there's been the largest income redistribution scam in American history. And it's been the middle class that's been looted while trillions keep flowing into the bank accounts of billionaires. Did you hear what I just said? Did you hear what I just said? This whole income redistribution thing we keep... Oh, you can't raise taxes on people? Because that will be income redistribution. You're a socialist. Well, guess what? The very people who are saying that, the very people who are funding think tanks that'll say that, the very people that are paying lobbyists to get the message out to say that, the very people who are spending millions and millions of dollars on lawyers and lobbyists on K Street who are saying that, they're the people who have scammed you. They're the people whose monopolies continue to be untouched. They continue to be untouched all because they can buy the best lobbyists, they can buy the best lawyers, they can buy the best influencers on Capitol Hill, across Washington, D.C., and across Wall Street. Please, please, Democrats, do better than that. Tax capital, take a dent on these super wealthy billionaires who keep accumulating, keep amassing fortunes. Because you're just, I mean, when you're taxing income a little bit more, 2% here, 3% here, you're missing the target. If you want to make this country a fairer place, if you want to get us back to where we were before, where there wasn't just such massive divergence between the super wealthy and the rest of Americans, you're going to have to rewrite your tax plan, because that one's just lousy.
I was absolutely shocked when I heard that from, I have to say again, former Republican congressman, Joe Scarborough was the Tea Party before it was the Tea Party. Joe Scarborough, when he was a congressman from Florida, was somebody who believed Newt Gingrich was too soft to be in Washington. That was Joe Scarborough's caucus. They ran Newt Gingrich out of town, to be quite honest about it, because they believed that Newt Gingrich was soft on Bill Clinton. Imagine that. The Joe Scarborough who thought Newt Gingrich was too soft is now on MSNBC on the show Morning Joe, who's saying things who I believe can be indistinguishable, almost when you hear that analysis, he sounds just like Bernie Sanders to me. So I'll just let those comments linger with you. You can go play them back. And I'll just say this as well. One of the billionaires that everybody pretends to like, it'd be probably because he plays a kind, gentle old man in his public persona, and I've never met the guy, is Warren Buffett. Now, Warren Buffett has he has a list of saying and ditties. I actually like him. He seems like a very wise man. And what Warren Buffett says a lot is, he talks about class warfare, right? And one of the quotes he says all the time is, there's been a class warfare for several years. It's been the class warfare where the rich have been waging war against the poor and the middle class, and the rich have been winning. And I think that goes in the same vein of what Joe Scarborough said. That if you're talking about being moderate, you're not being moderate if you are not looking at the way that the mega rich actually make their money, which they do not make their money off of payroll. It's not how they make their money. They make their money off of what we call capital gains, which is why people like the late, great Ed Schultz, who passed away, God rest his soul, used to propose things like a transaction tax. And a lot of people in Wall Street wrestled heavily against that. But I'm one of the people that I say, look, when I get these reports that I look at, because not just for the show, I'm kind of interested in how public policy works. I'm interested in finances, although I'm not an economist, and I see that a lot of these places are paying virtually no federal taxes, most of them zero federal taxes, period. A lot of them actually getting money back from the federal government because of these fancy tax maneuvers they use to actually pretend like they're losing money. It is the most brilliant thing that they are doing. And when I look at the fact that what they are doing is 100% legal, 100% legal, because this stuff is in the tax code, and they are just businesses who have hired brilliant accountants to take advantage of the tax code. So I don't demonize the rich. I don't demonize the businesses as an entity, right? I look at the people, the politicians, to be very frank, who have made the policy that the billionaires have then got a semi truck and ran right through year after year after year, where they can be a multinational corporation who has a monopoly on some industry and they're making almost just more money than God, and somehow are paying less taxes than their secretary. And I think we really need to have an open and honest conversation about what we should do about that. And we need to, if we could say, tax the rich or blah, blah, blah. I'm more interested in fixing all those loopholes in the tax code. But we can also raise the taxes on capital gains. So let's get into a bit of this conversation about Joe Manchin. I got some stuff on Kristen Sinema. I may play a bit of that. But let's go to one of his colleagues right now, Katie Porter. She tells us a bit about Joe Manchin.
Manchin, or is he more concerned about his corporate donors?
Democratic Congresswoman Katie Porter slammed fellow Democrat Joe Manchin and speculated as to why he is against the $3.5 trillion budget bill. Now, this is a bill that invests into climate change, universal pre-K, paid leave, Medicare expansion, including dental, vision, hearing, among other investments. But here you are seeing, as I'll talk about after the clip as well, you're seeing Democrats becoming a lot more willing to call out their own. And I love seeing this. So here's Katie Porter on MSNBC.
Now, with regard to Senator Manchin and others who want to talk about the price tag for this, let me be clear. You're a business person. You get it. You can do math. If something costs A, then you have two options. You can negotiate down from A, or you can find the money. We have revenue options on the table. There are a huge number of corporations that pay zero taxes. And by making savvy revenue choices, for example, using a real corporate profit approach to dealing with those corporations that pay zero, we could generate $700 billion. If we use the corporate minimum tax approach, we're going to generate $40 billion. Right there, Senator Manchin, right there, anyone who's worried about spending, we can generate the revenue so that this isn't about $3.5 trillion in spending. It's not even now about $3.5 trillion in spending, because we're going to generate the revenue to pay for these things. I have the will to do it. The question is, does Senator Manchin, or is he more concerned about his corporate donors, including large corporations, the oil and gas industry, the big pharmaceutical industry, and others who are getting away with paying nothing under our current tax system?
All right. Now, I do have one more clip coming up of somebody else that you may be a little surprised to see pushing the passage, the idea of passing this budget bill. But before I get to that, Katie Porter, of course, fantastic here. Seeing progressive Democrats become more willing to call out fellow Democrats, the corporate tools in their party, this is something that was unheard of, unseen, just 4 years ago. But it's now the norm when it comes to people like Katie Porter. I'll show you some others here. Rashida Tlaib, in response to Jim Clyburn saying that, you know, he can negotiate down $3.5 trillion. Rashida Tlaib replies saying, no, $3.5 trillion is the floor. This from Ilhan Omar is great as well. So Mehdi Hasan tweeted out a clip about Joe Manchin in January calling up or discussing how he'd be open to $4 trillion. Now, all of a sudden, he doesn't support that. But Ilhan Omar here, replying saying maybe his weekly huddles with Exxon might explain his change of heart. So they are just directly calling out the fact that he is a corporate tool. And these are just two examples. Of course, AOC has called him out as well. Jamal Bowman's called him out as well. Mondaire Jones has called him out as well. So there is a consistent theme here. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure what their ultimate goal is here, because you can call the guy out a million times. He's not really going to change what he's doing. But it's important to create the groundswell, the pressure from Democratic voters that are ones that just watch cable news, that haven't in the past normally seen these sorts of criticisms of Democrats coming from fellow Democrats. So to build that pressure within the media by talking to these more diehard Democratic voters and having them develop this hate for Joe Manchin can become a very powerful tool. So this fight, of course, over this will continue going on. But there's one more clip I want to show you. So this sort of, you know, discussion around Manchin is apparently appearing to even have an impact on leadership in the Democratic Party. So here is Joe Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, on CNN this week discussing Bernie's budget bill.
This package adds nothing to the debt. Nothing to the debt. It is fully paid for by raising taxes on wealthy people. We've had people become billionaires during the pandemic. They should pay their fair share of taxes. We've had 55 big corporations pay nothing in taxes, though they have record profits. If we raise taxes on the big corporations who aren't paying, raise taxes on people using international loopholes, raise taxes on the wealthy who are not paying their fair share, we can pay for every one of those investments in the package without a penny of taxes on people making under $400,000 a year and without a penny being added to the long-term federal debt. In fact, passing these tax changes, making the people who aren't paying pay their fair share, collecting taxes from people who owe them and are dodging taxes by using loopholes, using lawyers and accountants, collecting those taxes will make our tax system fairer, make middle-class people share less of the burden, mm-hmm. and can help bring down our debt in the long run. So I think Senator Manchin's concerns about inflation, about debts, those are concerns we can address with the provisions of this package itself.
So there is Joe Biden's chief of staff essentially taking on the Bernie Sanders lines, talking about taxing these massive corporations, talking about the billionaires that made money during the pandemic and how they should be taxed. So this is the kind of thing you, again, is new. In the past, a bill like this, a budget bill with a massive investment into actual people that would actually help people, expanding Medicare, expanding childcare, actual money investment into climate change. This is the kind of thing that normally would be scoffed at in the past by these sorts of Democrats, by people like Biden's chief of staff. But now they're being embraced. And part of the reasoning for that is because of the power that continues to grow within the Democratic Party from these progressive lawmakers. So they continue every cycle to primary out more and more members of leadership, be it Joe Crowley, Elliot Engel, Lacey Clay, and they will continue to do that. And this is how you gain power. And in gaining power, you also gain respect, and you also begin to have actual power when it comes to lawmaking. So because they have this power now, because they've grown to a point where they can actually say, you know what, we're not going to vote for the infrastructure bill unless we get this budget bill passed first. Because they've grown the numbers to the point where they can do that, they have some real power now. And it's having even an impact on Joe Biden. So it's, you know, it's incredible to see members of leadership that normally would simply capitulate to the Joe Manchins of the world actually now fight him and fight to push these two bills through, because they understand that neither's getting passed without the other.
So I don't want the show to run remarkably long. I did have some other stuff that I really wanted to get to. Some really a heartbreaking testimony from a lot of these athletes, gymnasts, when they went to the Congress to testify about what happened to them at the hands of one of these doctors, and these are people while they're winning these top medals for the country. So I'm going to put that on the next show. I'm going to play another clip. Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin kind of have started having a conversation back and forth with each other in the media. I'm actually going to end the show with a series of conversations about, let's just say, these two clashes. Let's get to the clips.
So the Senate returns from recess today at a crucial time for President Biden's spending plans. And two veteran Democratic lawmakers are clashing over the plans. One of the plans. Earlier this month, Senator Joe Manchin wrote an op-ed detailing his opposition to the $3.5 trillion reconciliation package. In that op-ed, he focused on expanded education investments, climate change policies, federal health care benefits, and permanent universal child tax credits. On Sunday, Manchin doubled down on these objections. Not only does he have a problem with some of the programs in the package and the price tag on the plan, he also disagrees with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's September 27th deadline.
Everything I've said, put a pause on. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we basically put a pause on with all the unknowns that we have right now we're facing? Don't know where COVID's going to go. Inflation is still very high and rampant. And then on top of that, the geopolitical unrest that we have going on, we might be challenged there. Don't you think we ought to be prepared for that?
Are you hard now?
On the 3.5?
Yes. Okay.
And then there's Senator Bernie Sanders, chair of the influential Senate Budget Committee. Senator Sanders responded to Manchin's opposition by calling it, quote, not acceptable. He also pointed out the compromises already made by many progressives in the party.
Many of us made a major compromise in going from the $6 trillion bill that we wanted, supported by the overwhelming majority of Democrats, down to 3.5. I know that Senator Manchin worked very hard on what's called a bipartisan infrastructure bill, $550 billion of new money to rebuild our roads and our bridges. What we have worked on is working both of those bills in tandem. They go together. And it would be a really sad state of affairs for the American people, for Congress, if both of those bills went down.
Sanders and Manchin, in many ways, represent the ideological poles of the Democratic Party. I mean, think about it. They're both in the Democratic Party. But with two veteran senators at odds, and in this current 50-50 Senate, Manchin may be the biggest obstacle to Sanders and Biden getting everything they want. Joining me now is Democratic strategist and MSNBC political analyst Juanita Toliver. So Juanita, in the clip from Sunday, Senator Sanders pointed out that progressives have already compromised on this bill by cutting costs. Do progressives need to compromise further, or do they need to get louder?
I think they need to get louder, Zerlina. You, as Senator Sanders said, as you reiterated, this was already a negotiation down from what some argue is essential to meet this moment. And so $3.5 trillion is a compromise. And so what I think progressives are going to do, and what you can expect more of, is them continuing to threaten the future of the bipartisan infrastructure deal that we know folks like Senator Manchin and folks like Senator Sinema desperately want to see pass. And so they are using leverage in a way that Senator Manchin can't ignore. They're showing him, hey, we know how to check you. We know how to make sure that you hear us. And we know how to make sure that the original plan, which was always to run these two bills on parallel tracks, we see it through. It's critical that they don't let up on this, because we know across the country, not only do 75% of voters want this and support the Build Back Better agenda, but absolutely should not have the Build Back agenda sunken by a fellow Democrat. What sense does that make? And honestly, Zerna, I wish we weren't here, right? Like, the fact that Democrats aren't using everything in their power, every tool, every ounce of their energy to pass legislation that we know will help people is honestly a disservice to the Democratic voters.
Why doesn't the president just call up Joe Manchin on the phone and be like, look, Joe, nobody would even be talking about you unless we won those two Senate seats in Georgia, Joe. So as a Democrat, the majority is only based on the turnout of Black, Brown, Indigenous voters, Latinx voters, in these critical battleground states. Like, nobody would be talking about you but for them. So don't you have a responsibility to those voters as well to protect their ballot access, to ensure they get these majority
supported policy legislation? I mean, I'm just, you know, hypothetical. That's how I feel like the conversation could go. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that conversation can go. I think the other thing Biden would say in that conversation is, look, you're going to sink all the work we put into negotiating with Republicans. I know that you want to show West Virginian voters that we can be bipartisan. Why are you sabotaging us? And so President Biden is absolutely going to present that to Senator Manchin in that conversation, which we don't know, but I would presume is already starting to take place. They already had phase one, like back a couple of months ago when they even announced the bipartisan deal. And I feel like every single time Manchin drops an op-ed, they have another one and they keep going back to the drawing board with him. But it's important that he gets checked. And what I also like about checking Manchin on this is the fact that you have Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi saying, we're going full steam ahead. Manchin better get on board right now, because as Senator Sanders said, is it right for one person to sink both of these bills? And we know the answer is, of course not. People need it too much. Families who have been struggling well before this pandemic need these type of investment. Towns that have been flooded by hurricanes, as we saw last week, need these investments. It's there, and he keeps talking about there's no need to rush. I'm like, there is a need to rush. People need it now, and we know that Democrats have a mandate to deliver.
One of the lines that folks have said in the past about the Democratic Party is that Democrats are in disarray. And in this particular moment, I think you can see a little bit of the disarray. Is there a way to get a raid? Is there a way to, for Democrats to find compromise within? Yeah, right. How do the Democrats get information? That's exactly the right way to put it. In terms of this infrastructure package, this spending bill, but also voting rights and the other things that are really just sitting there, but the filibuster looking at them like, what are you going to do about it?
You know who's going to get Democrats information is the same advocates who've been beating down their doors since the start of this Congress. Look, when the Georgia races were called, I remember posting, I was talking to Art Melber about this. Democrats need to act accordingly. Act like you know what it means to be in power. Act like you know how to not have this type of infighting, and they have absolutely let folks down. But the same advocates who are pounding at their door, the same people calling for them to eliminate the filibuster, are going to be the same activists and organizers they're expecting to mobilize voters in the midterms, in the next presidential election, and beyond. And so they cannot ignore these voices. Manchin can be bodied. And I think what we're seeing right now is an example of how to get him under control. How to get Manchin information is by threatening legislation that we know is important to him. Threatening the fact that he does not run the Hill. He is alone is not going to be the foil to the Democratic Party. And we know exactly where to apply pressure. That's the message you're hearing from progressives. That's the message you're going to keep hearing, especially as more issues come up. Because before it was voting rights, needed to end the filibuster for voting rights. Now it's about abortion and reproductive care. Need to end the filibuster for any person who can become pregnant to make sure that constitutional rights are accessible and people can act on them of their own free will. And so I think there's going to be more pressure applied to the Manchin and to Democrats writ large from advocates, and they won't be able to ignore because they're going to be picking up the phone calling them as we get closer to November.
Senator Joe Manchin, a conservative Democrat in the Senate, is bought off by the fossil fuel industry. There's no question about it. You just see the dollar signs and it tells you all you need to know. Now, despite his massive conflicts of interest, he is now claiming that, no, he's not bought off. He's playing defense because Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez called him out for being beholden to the fossil fuel industry. Now, I love this video because here's Joe Manchin playing defense.
I'm sure you've heard your fellow Democrat, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, said this about you in a tweet. Manchin has weekly huddles with Exxon and is one of many senators who gives lobbyists their pen to write so-called bipartisan fossil fuels bills. It's killing people. Sick of this bipartisan corruption that masquerades as clear-eyed moderation. This is your fellow Democrat.
What?
Is it true that you have weekly meetings with Exxon and other lobbyists for fossil fuel?
No, they don't. Weekly meetings, I don't.
It's just false.
I keep my door open for everybody. It's totally false. And those type of superlatives, it's just awful. Continue to divide. I don't know the young lady that well. I really don't. I've met her one time, I think, between sets here. But that's it. So we have not had any conversations. She's just speculating and saying things because she wants to.
She's not the only one. I'm sure you've heard. There are a number of your fellow Democrats who say that you're opposed to this because you're
paid for by corporate donors. It makes no sense at all.
That was fantastic, and it shows you the type of leverage and power that progressive lawmakers can have if they're willing to call out their own when they're more willing to basically protect corporate interests as opposed to the best interests of their own constituents.
Okay, so this is great news. We're now having a national conversation about whether Joe Manchin is bought off by his corporate donors. And so... Look, I think Dana Bash did a really good job in that interview. She was tough and asked the questions you needed to ask. The next interview, we might even get a follow-up on who his donors are. Because once you find out who the donors are, it gets worse and worse. I do know someone who asked that question. We'll get to him later. Fine, it's me.
Oh, you're unbearable.
Okay. Okay, no, but seriously, this is really important. And I only give that as an example of what should happen on a regular basis. But no corporate Democrat was ever asked about their donors until Just Democrats came in and now finally have brought this issue forward. And not just Democrats, wonderful progressives like Katie Porter. And now it forces, just what did I tell you guys? It forces the media to then ask them about it. Now we're having the right conversation. Why is Joe Manchin doing what he's doing? And so I got so much more on that. But thank you to AOC and the others for us finally getting to the heart of the matter. What actually motivates them to vote the way that they do?
Yeah, and before I get to the second part of Manchin's interview with CNN, I do want to give you the tweet that sparked this conversation in the first place. AOC had tweeted the following: Manchin has weekly huddles with Exxon and is one of many senators who gives lobbyists their pen to write so-called bipartisan fossil fuel bills. It's killing people, our people, at least 12 last night, sick of this bipartisan corruption that masquerades as clear-eyed moderation. And of course, she's responding to Manchin's op-ed where he makes clear that he is against the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill, which includes incredibly important provisions, including climate action, paid family leave, and expansion of Medicare to include dental and, you know, vision. And so I love the fact that she hit pretty hard in that tweet. It apparently had an effect. And here's the second part of the interview.
Your own facts. I mean, your own opinions. You're just not entitled to create your own facts to support it. And that's exactly what they're doing. The facts I've given you is the transition's happening. Reliability. Look what happened in Texas. It was natural gas that basically shut down in Texas that caused all that horrible carnage of people. It was awful.
You have said pause. What the Senate wants to do is get this worked out by this week so that the House can vote on it September 27th. Is that a timeline that you can support in any way?
There's no way we can get this done by the 27th if we do our job. There's so much differences that we have here and there's so much apart from us where we are as far as our, I'm giving you different things. I've been talking, I'm working with people, I'm willing to talk to people. It makes no sense at all.
There's so much to unpack in that clip. And I want to debunk much of what he had to say, which means, you know what? It's time to take a trip to the debunker.
You didn't see Republicans, when we had control of the Senate, try to rig the game.
That shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America.
Our systems are not racist.
So, Cenk, two quick things I want to mention before I toss to you. Number one, this is a side note, but Manchin, in a very weaselly way, just said that people died in Texas during that winter storm because of the natural gas failing the people of Texas. No, it's a deregulated, privatized energy grid that failed the people of Texas. Since it was deregulated, it was not weatherized to withstand the temperatures that Texans were experiencing during that winter storm. That's a side note. Getting back to the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill, he claims he has a problem with the spending. Then why did he vote in favor of the framework for that bill, which clearly stated that it would spend $3.5 trillion? Now he's backing away from it And gee, I wonder why. Could it be that he has these weekly meetings with his donors, including ExxonMobil, which we'll get to in just a second. Jake.
Yeah. So I like the line that David Sirota had the other day. We're now negotiating this with a coal baron who lives on a luxury yacht. And that's who Joe Manchin is. So when we are debunking him, understand that he has, as we've mentioned many times, not just corporate contributions to his campaigns, but personal money invested in the coal industry. So that's why he keeps saying it doesn't make any sense. And in a way, to be fair to him, it doesn't for him. He'd lose money. Now, we would save the planet, but for him, that doesn't make sense. He doesn't want to lose any money. So I want to contribute to this. In going back to the first video, he said, I keep my door open. And he said, you know, every week? I don't know. Look, I don't know about every week. In other words, yes, you do meet with them all the time with great regularity. In fact, a Jar of Jambangino member here wrote in, not weekly meetings. Oh, okay, so what is it, bi-weekly then? But it was very clear from his answer. He said, in the middle of it, I keep my door open. That means, yes, I definitely have meetings with lobbyists. And so he said, the superlatives are awful when you point out the fact. And later he said facts are not negotiable. But at that time, he's like, you want to point out a fact about my regular meetings with lobbyists? Well, that is just a superlative, and that is divide, divide, divide.
She don't like that.
Yeah. Corruption, not awful. Pointing out corruption, awful. That is a normal talking point in Washington, D.C. And if you notice, and AOC later took umbrage with this, he called her a young lady instead of a congresswoman. Now, you can say, hey, that's nitpicking. But she made an interesting point, AOC did, which she said, now, if I used age and gender, would that seem okay? So if I say, oh, I haven't met the old man, okay, but I hear he says this, and I was like, oh, damn, that's a really good point. Like, no one would find that acceptable. And she further added, he's using that kind of language not because AOC needs a title or she needs some respect in that sense, but he's using it in a way to put her down, like this young lady who doesn't know how Washington works. Within the context of his answer, it's clear that that's his implication.
To diminish the power she has, really.
Yes.
That's what it's really about.
Yeah.
So I also want to remind you all of something we learned about earlier this year when a senior ExxonMobil lobbyist mentioned Joe Manchin by name as he was interviewed for what he believed was another position at a different company. Now, he didn't know he was being recorded, but here's what he had to say.
Who's the crucial guys for you?
Well, Senator Capito, who is the who chairs the Senate, who's the ranking member of Environment and Public Works, Joe Manchin. I talk to his office every week. He is the kingmaker on this because he's a Democrat from West Virginia, which is a very conservative state. So he is, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate. So. On the Democrat side, we look for the moderates on these issues. So it's the Manchins, it's the Sinemas, it's the Testers.
Oh, that senior ExxonMobil lobbyist just said that he speaks to Joe Manchin every week. Joe Manchin, the kingmaker, speaks to him every week. Seems like Representative Ocasio-Cortez was absolutely correct in stating very specifically how often Joe Manchin meets with fossil fuel lobbyists.
And there's another thing that Keith McCoy said there that's really relevant. Joe Manchin isn't normally shy about it, but here we've come to an interesting intersection because he will go and take checks from the Chamber of Commerce right before a statement or right after a statement where he basically supports their legislative priorities, and he kills corporate tax cuts, then goes to the Chamber of Commerce and just says, give me the money, give me the money. Now, though, he's being called out for his corporate donors in the press for the first time in national media. And so before he was brazen about it, because there's no downside. You can go collect those checks, you can show it to people, hey, I just got bribed. And the Restaurant Association is a perfect example. Right after he kills minimum wage, he goes and collects checks from them. I mean, normally if you had a functioning press in America, they'd be like, oh my God, look at the outrage. That looks like outright bribery, right? And Manchin used to walk around with checks like taped to his head in Washington, and no one ever pointed it out. And so now, being pointed out by a fellow Democrat, then on CNN, My guess is he'll be a little less brazen now. So we'll see if he takes a couple of patches off of his NASCAR suit, right?
Doubt it.
But there's no question that ExxonMobil lobby is saying, oh, yeah, that's my boy, okay? That's the guy we go to get ExxonMobil a good hearing under the dome, as they say. Now, one other thing, throughout that interview, he kept saying about how there's no urgency for this $3.5 trillion bill. He said, on the other hand, there is urgency, and he kept using the same word over and over again, about the $1 billion so-called bipartisan bill.
Yeah, the corporate handout bill.
Yeah, the corporate-backed one, right? So why is he saying that? Because he can say, oh, yeah, the $3.5 trillion, I'm like, we're going to negotiate. I'll do something along those lines. But later, let's vote on the one that's corporate-backed first. Well, that's the oldest trick in the book. So he apparently thinks it's still the old days where you can do that trick. And we're about to find out, because the old days were like a minute ago. So if the progressives say no, you're either passing them both at the same time or you're not passing your corporate-backed one, then he'll find out it's the new days and he actually has to negotiate.
Well, the good news is, on that same episode, the other senator who was interviewed was Bernie Sanders. And during that interview, he made abundantly clear that progressives will not pass the bipartisan corporate handout bill unless they pass the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. They're not kidding. They're now on the record multiple times making it very clear that they are willing to sink the bipartisan bill unless they get exactly what they want with the reconciliation bill. Now, look, they're going to negotiate. Are a few things likely to be either cut down or cut back a little in that bill? It's likely, right? The real question is to what extent. But nonetheless, I do find it interesting that back in 2017, Senator Joe Manchin was asked point blank whether he is influenced by his corporate donors. He didn't really seem too scared of that line of questioning. Maybe he minimized independent media in that case. But I do want to remind you all of how that interview went down.
But you voted to repeal the stream protection rule. And your top donor is First Energy that wound up getting in some degree of trouble for putting arsenic in a pond. It seems like they would benefit from the repeal of that regulation. So did that have anything to do with your vote?
No. Jenks, I know it's hard to believe, and I know it's hard for people to... I don't have any idea who gives me money. I don't solicit from the standpoint that you do this for me, quid pro quo. That's never been me. That's not my political mantra at all.
This is the list of your top donors. I thought you said that you don't... I understand that you said you don't do quid pro quo. That was clear.
Yeah.
But you know who your top donors are, right?
I do not.
You don't know who your top donors are?
I do not. You're showing me something I've never seen.
Okay, so this is from Open Secrets.
I know you have, Jenks. I know that is hard for anyone to believe. I do not.
I do not, Jenks. I do not. Yeah. He's totally in the dark about who his donors are. I'm sure he has no idea as he's fundraising for his reelection campaigns. I'm sure he has no idea at all.
Guys, if you know Washington at all, that is actually the most outrageous fabrication anyone could ever
say. I know it's
say.
Hard to believe, Jenks. I know it's hard to believe.
There's a good reason why it's hard to believe.
No one should believe it.
Yes, they know who their top donors are with great specificity. That is the one thing they are all obsessed with. The idea that a sitting senator wouldn't know who his top donors are is patently absurd. And so I'm hoping that's the next level we get to in mainstream media, where they can say, hey, look, here's a graphic of your top donors. It looks like there are a lot of energy companies and drug companies, mm-hmm. and it looks like your votes match their interests nearly perfectly. That's the interview we had here on The Young Turks. It was a little uncomfortable at times. Well, that's called journalism.
And I just want to direct you guys to one more piece of data regarding campaign donations that go to people like Joe Manchin, specifically from fossil fuel companies. Analysis of campaign disclosures found the six Democratic senators, Senator Mark Kelly, Maggie Hassan, Joe Manchin, Chris Coons, Kyrsten Sinema, and John Tester received a combined total of nearly $333,000 from lobbyists, political action committees, and lobbying firms affiliated with Exxon over the past decade. So it's not just about Manchin. Manchin just tends to be the most vociferous in speaking out against the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill. But understand that corporate Democrats in the Senate are and will continue to be a problem unless they're taken to task over their conflicts of interest, not just through corporate lobbying and the money that they receive from legalized bribery, but also from their personal investments in fossil fuel companies. Joe Manchin makes $500,000 a year alone from being invested in a fossil fuel company, in a coal company, and that's a problem. Obviously, that's a conflict of interest, and he should be completely divested from it. But $500,000 is more than double what he receives in his Senate salary. So I doubt that's going to happen unless laws are passed to make it so.
Yeah, we'll provide a link down below in the description box for that interview that I did with Joe Manchin about 4 years ago. It was really interesting. Check it out if you can. Always check out the description box. Good links in there quite often.
I'd love to get back into the price conversation, but I do want to make this point, and I want to play you what the president said, and I think it's clarifying to follow up on that. So I want to say, play what President Biden said today, and then ask you a clarifying question. Take a listen for a second.
My Republican friends are attacking my plan, saying it's big spending. Let me remind you, these are the same folks who just 4 years ago passed the Trump tax cut, totaling almost $2 trillion in tax cuts, a giant giveaway to the largest corporations in the top 1%. And listen to this, almost none of that $2 trillion tax cut was paid for. It just ballooned the federal deficit.
Okay, so here's part of the thing that has been driving me nuts about the discourse on this bill. The cost is just one part of the ledger of the bill, right? I'm not crazy here. There's a cost part, and then there's a revenue raisers part, and people only talk about the cost part. Like, there are, right, that you couldn't pass it through reconciliation if it was just going to charge it to the deficit, right? I mean, have I lost the plot here?
Well, you could. Actually, you could, but we're not going to do that. I mean, what we intend... Look, the bill is still being worked on. The bill is still being worked on.
You get rid of all these tax raises that the oligarchs don't like and pass this thing and charge it and come back the next day.
All right, but what we want to do is, in fact, pay for it. If I had my druthers, I would pay for every nickel of it. By demanding, as the president just said, that we end the absurdity of large corporations making billions and in a given year paying nothing in federal income taxes. Some of the wealthiest people in this country, Elon Musk, I think, Jeff Bezos, in a given year, do not pay a nickel in federal income tax. Anyone think that that is vaguely sane? It is not. So what we can do in one way or another, in a variety of ways, raise the revenue that we need to pay for this. And by the way, Chris, your point about, taking a look at what we are trying to do. The evidence is overwhelming that when you invest in childcare, when you invest in education, when you invest in children, you get that investment back many times over. And in terms of climate, what are we supposed to say? How do you deal with this issue? How much is too much when you're talking about saving the planet? How much? And if the planet goes down in 50 years, well, gee whiz, how much should we have spent or not spent? It's pretty crazy stuff. And what even every economist understands, economic output is going to decline precipitously because of climate, not to mention the huge amounts of money we spend trying to repair the damages of storms and floods. So the president, in my view, again, I said this before, deserves credit for, with no margin in the Senate, 50-50, three-vote margin in the House. He understands, I understand, I think the majority of the American people understand, because what we are doing is enormously popular. The American Rescue Plan was popular. This is popular. The American people want us to address the crises facing working people and have the guts, finally, to stand up to the big money interest who own the United States Congress.
You named the most difficult part of this, which is that you need a unanimous vote. And unanimity is tough. You come out of some universe of old left, unanimous consensus groups, in a basement trying to get 12 people to agree on something. It's not easy.
It is very difficult. And I hope people appreciate that. I mean, if we had 60 or 70 votes, it would make life a lot easier. We got zero votes. Right. We got 50 votes in the Senate, and Nancy Pelosi has three-vote margin in the House. So this is really, really tough. And there's going to be a lot of debate and discussion going on. Trust me. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to do what the American people want and pass the most consequential piece of legislation.
The Terrell McClain Show is fully listener-supported, independent media that won't lead you to tribalism. Get a membership for as little as $3 a month to support independent media at www.patreon.com/The Terrell McClain Show.